Well, as I understand it, and good job, Tim, and thank you, Lex, for the consult. I think we've worked out the coasttocoastam.com website issues in regard to the slideshow that was put together by Charles Ostman. So go to it now if you'd like. Charles will walk through part of that next to tell you about the images he wanted to tell us about last hour, but I think they're all up and it's all working. So we'll get to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, I suppose I probably should have looked through all of the pictures before I encouraged everybody else to go there all at once, because now I can't get it to work for me. But we did get the gallery functional. You can do the slideshow feature if you just go to coasttocoastam.com. Click on to those pictures. These are all photos and or images that were submitted by Charles Ostman relating to his appearance tonight. And as it says here, including amongst them are insights on transmutation, gravity manipulation, secret government projects, and weather manipulation. So now that we know that the pictures are up, Charles, where do you want to start?
Well, I can start with the first one, and it's just a generic shot of the Super Hadron Collider. And by the way, I should point out, we tried to do this ourselves, and the project was canceled. It was called the Superconducting Super Collider. It was actually going to be built here in California, and that was, in fact, in the early 80s, just as I was leaving SDI and going into the private sector, into other areas. That's when the project was sort of on the table. And in fact, they got as far as it got moved to Texas because of some political problems here to do with labor unions and whatever. So they sent it to Texas, and they spent, I don't know how many billions, but they spent quite a few billions of dollars digging this giant hole, and then the plug got pulled, and they decided to cancel the whole thing. And what ended up was they got replicated in Europe, and it's now called the Super Hadron Collider. And the reason this is such an interesting thing is because, I mean, there's many different aspects to this, but one is the ability to create antimatter on demand, which is a big deal. And the reason that, perhaps I should explain what transmutation is, so forgive me. So if I may, I'll just put that in there. Transmutation is the ability to convert one element to another. And in fact, we did this at Lawrence Laboratory. I didn't, but people I knew did. Just for fun, they actually converted lead into gold. This really happened. That was in 1976. And the way this is done is that you take a known element of a certain size and you temporarily rupture its nucleus, and then you allow it to sort of reassemble into a different element. And there's something called the table of nuclides. And in fact, the second slide, and let's see if I can pull it up myself. I'm not sure I can, but I'll try. I'm pulling it now. Let's hope this works. But anyway, if you can pull it up, there it is. Lovely. The table of nuclides shows the what are called daughter elements. These are all of the potential decay elements that a given core element can be converted to. An isotope is an element that has an imbalance of protons and neutrons in its core, and then it tries to eject or readjust itself by ejecting both particles and emissions of energy to a more stable form. And the reason this is so interesting is because even if the element doesn't exist in nature, you can theoretically design an element to suit a certain purpose. And in some cases, there are certain elements that if you can create them, even just for a few femtoseconds, they will possess other particles that are of interest. And so one of the big holy grails is the production of antiprotons. You're thinking, well, what's that got to do with anything? Well, the whole idea is if one can then combine protons and antiprotons, you get a tremendous amount of energy. This is a real thing. In fact, I remember in the movie that just came out, Demons and whatever it was called, I forget the name of the film.
Angels and Demons. Angels and Demons.
It was a great film, and I thought I should remember the name of it. But the opening scene was creating antimatter. That actually is a real thing. I mean, the rest of it I'm not sure about, but that part of it, actually, the physics is correct. And the third slide, which if I can pull it up, but it actually shows you a Lockheed Martin project involving transmutation. And the point, whoops, that doesn't come up. Well, two of the slides came up. Anyway, the point is, what I find extremely interesting is that Lockheed Martin has, of course, invested heavily in this. And, you know, they're not saying exactly why. Now, other parts of the world, Japan and France, have been using transmutation actually to reduce the radioactivity signature of isotopes that are left over from nuclear reactors. And just to segue a little bit, one of the big problems with nuclear power is that even with the modern pellet-sized reactors, the ones that use the pellets, these are much smaller reactors, they still have, you know, the waste, which they have to get rid of. So one of the ways to get around this, to be able to transmutate these radioactive elements into more stable elements so they won't be so dangerous. And that was kind of the lead-in for the industry. However, because of the fact that transmutation equipment is now becoming more accessible or being developed in various places of the world, one of the other benefits is you can create these designer elements on demand. And so if that's already been established, then, of course, you get to create these antiprotons. And you're probably asking, why would that be interesting? the answer would be that if you're going to try to create contrived gravity wells on demand, this is exactly the kind of procedure you want to get to be able to deliver that kind of energy release in a very short amount of time to create that kind of gravity well.
Okay, and so and this is helpful to have a gravity well to do what?
To instead of having to propel an object using a rocket or some kind of a modified jet engine, instead you're going to create what looks like a artificial gravity well in front of the object and it's pulled towards it. In other words, imagine like taking a flashlight and you shine the light into the night sky and the beam sort of stops at a certain point. Well, imagine if that beam was in fact a gravity well, something that you would fall towards. So just like when you're standing on the surface of the Earth and you drop a ball or an apple or whatever and it falls to the ground, the reason is because it's being pulled to the center of the mass of the planet. Well, in a sense, you're creating like an artificial planet. This is kind of a very bad analogy, but you're creating what appears to be what's called an apparent mass. And that apparent mass has a gravitational pull to it. So you're being pulled towards this arbitrary temporary mass or apparent mass that you can then sort of pull yourself around. In other words, you get to then negate the gravity around you, and you have a completely independent way of moving that does not require propulsion.
Well, help me understand this, and I am the dumbest guy I know, but that sounds like tractor beams Star Trek.
In a way it is, exactly. Imagine a tractor beam. Instead of attracting something to you, you're pulling yourself towards this artificially contrived moment of gravity.
Right, so we're not shooting something up. We're creating an artificial tractor beam that pulls something up.
Correct.
We're essentially falling up.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
By creating this gravity well, yes, we're exactly. Falling up.
That's right, or falling whatever direction you point the gravity well towards.
Right, but I mean, you know, in the case of going into space, and then
correct.
And the at what speed would one be going?
And that's the whole point. It could be any speed. I mean, I don't want to sound, you know, sort of arbitrary, but I mean, I don't know if it's good speed of light, but certainly you're not limited by. I mean, to the escape velocity to get off the ground requires a certain amount of thrust versus the mass of the rocket you're trying to propel, and a bunch of boring physics I won't go into. But there's a whole bunch of rules that says you can only propel so much with so much fuel at a certain velocity. That all disappears when you have this other method, because the gravity around you becomes sort of a non-issue. You create your own gravity bubble, in a sense, and you sort of float inside this bubble, and you just get pulled around. That's why when you see these objects doing, you know, right-angle turns at high velocity, and they can just zip around, they're not affected by the gravity around them. It's a completely different set of rules.
And so your belief is that those things which we can see with the highest grade night vision goggles,
yep.
That those objects are in fact terrestrial based ships.
Yeah, I would. I mean, to me, I kind of go for the Occam's razor approach. In other words, it could be ET. I'm not saying it couldn't be, but I'm just saying it's also equally possible that there's something that we're experimenting with, and I would guess that perhaps others are experimenting with as well.
And
it could be both. I mean, it could be both. I'm just saying that would be a likely possibility.
And that you're offering as a possibility that the propulsion system for this would be these sort of instant gravity wells.
Correct.
Now, it's actually, in a way, kind of reminds me a little bit of Spider-Man's webs that he would shoot out from his wrist.
I haven't visualized that, but it's an interesting way.
Well, hang on. I just mean that if we could direct it at any place we wanted.
Sure.
Does it have to get anchored onto something when we're creating the gravity well? It doesn't. It goes until where? I mean,
as long as you can create the time-space distortion. Again, some more boring physics stuff, and forgive me, but just one small more detail. There's something called torsion manifolds, and I promise I'm not going to get too far out there. But a torsion manifold is like this region in which you can then distort the time-space continuum within that defined region. And there's something called a fourth-dimensional hyperfield, and I won't bore with all that stuff. But the whole idea is you create this field that has an apparent time-space continuum that's different than the time-space continuum around it. That's probably the best way to explain that. It's like creating a bubble, and then within that bubble, you can create your own conditions.
Let's just go again with your Occam's razor theory that there is a that these are could be terrestrial based. These could be our ships.
Sure.
Then it makes the question I was about to ask seem irrelevant, which is how far away are we from this technology? You're implying that this technology is already here.
I would guess that it is, and let me take one more step further. Because of the tremendous global changes that we're seeing now, and not to get too political, but I mean, I think everybody knows that we're shifting into a new kind of global economic paradigm. And however that turns out, that could be a different set of people to discuss that. We're better equipped. describe those events. But the background is that because there's this global economic shift going on, there is a kind of a Cold War of sorts. Again, not a shooting war, but a war of seeing who can dominate the global economic system as it might evolve. And that's a really big question mark, and there's lots of variables. But a piece of that would be whoever can demonstrate and utilize this technology to their own advantage clearly would have the upper hand in that contest. And so it would be very understandable that this would be kept completely dark. And in fact, I'm a little nervous even describing this, but since these things can be seen, I figure we might as well describe what we can see. And it would actually be quite logical that this would be something that would be kept in the dark for a long time, maybe some number of years ahead of time it'll come to light. But for the time being, it would be absolutely appropriate that this would be a kind of a black project or a clandestine project.
I'm not sure I understand ultimately why. I mean, I hear you saying that, but I don't know. Why couldn't we understand this is what we've achieved?
Because it would show our hand. And if you're going to play this kind of global chess, and if your opponents are also playing their version of global chess, you want to have your aces close to the vest, as it were. That's how I see it. And in my humble opinion, as I said in the letter I submitted to you, whoever owns the atmosphere owns the planet, and then beyond that, whoever owns space kind of owns the world economy. And that's what I see come around that point. And one of the motivations, by the way, most people would think in terms of weapons in space, and yes, I'm sorry to say there is weaponized space programs that are going on. And it's one of those other areas where if I could say no, I would say no, because I think it's a bad idea. But let's just go ahead with that. But the larger picture says that whoever can dominate space more effectively for a much lower cost and have a tremendous lead in terms of how they can manipulate through space could then begin to harvest minerals and energy. And that's really where the long-term game is.
Well, what are they waiting for? I mean, it would seem like, why do we keep selling all this money to the Chinese to keep our economy floating?
I know.
We could own the atmosphere and therefore own the planet.
Because it's not quite that simple. I mean, this is getting a little more esoteric, but it would make sense to not reveal this upper hand, because at the moment it's still a work in progress, and I think both sides are pushing at this very aggressively. As I said earlier, the Chinese space program is for the most part highly secret. They reveal very little what they're working on. And one of the things that people perhaps don't think about too often, but just a thought to consider in this context, the real agenda in the near future is not going to be oil or even access to fresh water, although I think that's going to be the next thing that's going to cause a lot of conflict around the world. The real thing that's around the corner is strategic minerals, and there's quite a variety of them, which are fast running out. In other words, all the stuff you see around you, your computers, your cell phones, all the technology that makes everyday life kind of what it is, most of that stuff relies on really obscure and esoteric minerals, which are being depleted at an astonishing rate.
Right.
And if the Chinese and the Indians and everybody else that suddenly comes online with their sort of development and the pace of development that's going now, these will be rapidly depleted. So again, if somebody had a vastly superior way to get out to, say, the asteroids or even to nearer sources than the moon for helium-3 as an example, that would be a spectacular advantage. And for a lot of reasons, you would not want to reveal that right away. You'd want to sort of have that as your ace in the hole as opposed to coming. I mean, I don't agree with these policies, but that's how I see it to be, because it's very common for how policies like that have worked in the past.
How long would it take us then to have one of these mining operations on another planet or on an asteroid or something?
I would guess if things are the way they might be, and I'm just guessing because of what I've seen personally, what others tend to... I've had this discussion with quite a range of folks, and the agreement seems to be more in the favor of that it is something that we've produced as opposed to something from ET. I mean, that's just casual conversation with a lot of my personal friends that actually work in the industry. But if that were to be the case, we're probably within a handful of years. Now, this is kind of interesting because if one were to step back a couple of paces, it's well known that our space shuttle goes offline in 2010, and according to all the public sources, we're going to be essentially without a major payload delivery system for probably 8 or 10 years. If one looks at the debt that we're now under the obligation with China and also with Saudi Arabia, by the way, we are really hurting in terms of our cash reserves, in terms of the value of the dollar. We're living on fiat currency now. Everyone knows it. In fact, the entire world is kind of shaking a little bit because the dollar has always been sort of the bedrock currency that everything else is established by, and that's kind of been a state of transition.
Right.
So the theory would be that we're about 10 years or so away from being able to recover to an economic status as we once were. That's the going thought right now. In the meantime, if we had this up our sleeves, it could be a sudden, you know, as the world begins to turn this other direction, this would be the way that we respond. This is the theory of mine, but it seems to fit with other agendas.
So that we would have already have developed this high speed, high altitude, perhaps either low level space or already working on having a some sort of interplanetary craft,
right, yeah,
that could effectively mine, you know,
not just other mine places, minerals, but also harvest energy. I have to remember now for almost over 25 years now, and in fact, starting with DOE, the very group
right.
of workers, we actually had on the drawing board a whole variety of different kinds of platforms, one of which that I think was particularly interesting was the ability to harvest sunlight and then convert that to a microwave and beam it down to Earth. Now, several versions of this technology have been sort of gone through its iterations, but the Japanese actually are about to build this very system as we're speaking, and I have no doubt whatsoever that the Russians and Chinese are collaborating on their version of it. Our first version was proposed to Congress over 25 years ago, and even to this very day, we're still sort of not really there, but at least that's what they tell us. But, you know, that's the next thing around the corner.
What's the trigger then? What do you imagine it would take for us to reveal the cards that we have up our sleeve right now?
One of the things that really scares me, and this is the reason I wrote the letter the way I did when it was assigned to say no, because I think that it may not be that far off that possibly, who knows, Iran may become a target. I mean, if they continue on the direction they're going, it seems kind of obvious that I would guess Israel may have to make their move on Iran. And if that were to be the case, I think that civil war would sprout up in Pakistan. It's already sort of civil war to the surface, but it would bring it to the surface. We would see much more of a hot war suddenly sprouting up in the Middle East and surrounding areas. I mean, it would take the already existing circumstances and make it vastly worse. It may be at some point, if the world really got to that level, and all of a sudden all the superpowers are starting to arm up their missiles and say, okay, what's the next move? We might at that moment pull this out of our sleeve. But that's just a guess. I'm just completely speculating. I'm not basing off that. I'm just saying, looking at the chessboard, that's kind of one possibility.
So, at least in some limited sense, you're talking a kind of on the brink of World War III.
I would hope not. Believe me, I don't want any
right.
of this. This is not something I look forward to at all. I'm just saying, as a worst-case scenario, it's one possibility.
That on the brink of World War III, that's when we might reveal all
that's
that we
right,
have.
Yeah, exactly.
It would take something like that for us to do it.
That's right.
And how far away, if we're able to do this, then how far away are the Chinese or the Russians? And does that bring us back to the Norway spiral?
That's kind of where I was leading to because, again, the Russians were perhaps not as far along in terms of the amount of money they could spend, but they clearly had the knowledge and the physicists and the people who understood these kinds of physics. It's not for lack of brain power. The only thing that was holding them back really was their economy. And now that they have the ultimate, now they have the world's most powerful economy sort of fueling their military interest. That's kind of interesting. And meanwhile, we're in debt because we got engaged in a war in Iraq that makes no sense to anyone. I mean, you can explain that if you wish. But it seems to me like we were sort of lured into this bizarre sort of geopolitical chess match that we kind of lost it, actually. We got, you know, sort of snookered into going to Iraq for a lot of reasons, which we can explain some other time if you wish. But that set us back a number of years. And the Russians and the Chinese, they saw this and said, you know, that's a perfect, you know, to them, it's like a perfect, you couldn't have designed a more cleverly designed trap, as it were. And that gives them the time to push on this as aggressively as they might be able to.
Fair point. Well, certainly neither the Russians nor the Chinese are helping us out in Iraq or Afghanistan right now. They know how to keep their powder dry. Okay, so then let's do this. In our last half hour here with Charles Ossman, let's go to the phones, and then we'll just transition to the top of the hour into open line calls for the rest of the night. But as I've been noticing, Charles, as we've spoken, I've seen several of the lines light up. I'm sure there's a couple of people that would love to get through to you. Charles Ossman, historian of the future. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponnett. So thank you so much. It's a Sunday night, and we'll do open lines coming up in just a little while. But first, we'll get to a couple of calls for Charles Ossman. We've been talking about the Norway spiral. If you didn't see that video, you happened to catch it earlier in the week on Coast to Coast. You can find it on the webpage right now. Just go onto my blog. Click onto that, and it's like the first link. Of a couple that are on the blog. So link onto that and go take a look at that. As you'll see, Charles has been talking about the technology that he believes might be already happening right now in the upper atmosphere, being revealed through very strong night vision goggles. You'd be able to see ships moving around that he says could be terrestrial, could be ours, and could be employing these kind of gravity wells where you're essentially you sort of create your own gravity and then you go with it in whatever direction you want to go. And that would explain a lot, he said, and he thinks that people will be revealing that coming up sometime in the future when we are on the brink of some disaster that perhaps could come about through further military incursions in the Middle East. That, as may be, what question would you have for Charles Ostman, the historian of the future, next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. So let's go west of the Rockies for Charles Ostman. John is in Reno on Coast to Coast. John?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Charles. Let me tell you a little story and just kind of see what you can make of it here. I used to play golf with a Chinaman for a long time, and we became pretty good friends. And in the end, we parted ways, you know, a couple of years later. And he looked me in the eyes with an extreme amount of hatred and said something about you Zionist pigs. You know, just wait. Just you guys just wait, basically, is what he said. You Americans, just wait. And now it's been 10 years later, and I'm watching the things that China is doing. It has me a little bit worried, basically. I've read their books about the art of war and deception and pretending to be your friend and really your enemy. I'm trying to make something out of it. I don't really know where it's all headed, but what I see, I don't like.
Well, I'll give you my own personal experience, which, you know, I'm just offering my view. I don't claim to be a scholar in the art form of transnational, global, you know, chess playing, although I've studied a lot of it. But I'll tell you what I personally have seen. Here in the Silicon Valley, I live in the Bay Area of California. Two things. First of all, the largest espionage organization ever put together in human history has come out of China in terms of the actual number of people involved, the scale and complexity, the amount of resource they've devoted to this. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands of Chinese who have been directly or indirectly involved with specifically taking technology from our country or interfering with our electronic infrastructure. A lot of the hacking rate that I subscribe to several different journals which have to do with electronic security and that sort of thing. And you wouldn't believe the number of attacks. Some of them get published, a lot of them don't. Some of them, they claim, come out of North Korea, but you have to remember, of course, that North Korea is essentially a proxy state of China. And in fact, a lot of the North Korean population, they're living in pretty horrible conditions, but the few that are well-fed and well taken care of are those high-tech specialists who specifically are the sort of electronic warfare arm of the Chinese military. So, I mean, it's an actual documented portion of their military effort. And here, there have been quite a few cases where people from China have become senior board members of various high-tech companies or in major management positions of governing, you know, overseeing various projects. And then, lo and behold, they disappear and the technology shows up in China. This is a real problem. It's a serious national security issue. And, it's happened here in the Bay Area, and it's certainly happened elsewhere in the country.
What are we doing with them? I mean, if our technologies are so far ahead in other respects, why are we lagging so far behind in electronic espionage, or why are we not doing it?
Well, I may not have a good answer, because there may be more. I mean, I don't claim to know all these things. I just claim to know what I can see. And what
I understand, but it just sort of seems like how odd would it be that we were unable to do what they are doing? And we might choose not to do it, but are we unable to do what they do?
I think, Ian, you just hit on it. I think we're, you know, this kind of chess playing is a very interesting art form. And quite often, the art of deception, as the caller so correctly pointed out, has a lot to do with not showing all your cards and even feigning a certain kind of weakness as a way to get the enemy to show their strategy.
And you can
sort of tool up for it, as it were.
All right. Keith is in Charleston, South Carolina, on Coast to Coast. Keith?
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. Excellent show tonight. I've got several questions for Charles, please. But I've been told to limit them down. So
yes.
As it comes to as it pertains to these gravitational wells, I would like to know what Charles thinks about the effects of time dilation in local areas by using these. And secondly, the effects on local tidal forces, if we were to, say, use something like this to launch a ship from the surface of the Earth in outer space, I understand it would
That's a great question.
Very little difference. But
How would that affect our tidal patterns? I totally see that.
Yeah, maybe not tidal patterns exactly, but remember, these are fairly small, confined torsion manifolds. Think in terms of a torsion manifold as being a fixed region in four-dimensional space that actually has more dimensions inside of it, and that's kind of a complicated explanation. But these can be fairly small, so it's not like you're going to, like, pull the entire ocean or something like this.
No.
Although there have been witness accounts where people have seen some objects like this, you know, fairly close to the surface. And on a couple of occasions, I've actually read accounts where they saw the water, you know, pulling up by a couple of feet, like there'd be like a round circle of water that was kind of rising upward, and then there would be an object floating overhead. So, I mean, that has been reported. I haven't seen it myself personally, but I have heard of accounts like that. And I'm sorry, the first question again, please. I'm so sorry. I couldn't quite
remember. Yeah, what was the first one? Keith, what was the first question?
These gravitational wells.
Okay, well, you mean in terms of how they're done or what the technology? Well, the current version that I'm aware of that I've seen papers on, and this came out of Russia and as well as some here, again, uses a proton, anti-proton reaction to create a very specific amount of energy in a very short amount of time confined to a certain amount of space. And that is part of the process that you can create a kind of a apparent mass of a certain size that would contrive a gravity. And you were asking about light, I guess, or time. That's what I was, time.
Time.
And yes, time would be distorted. Absolutely. There's something that
how would we live that distortion? How would that affect us?
Inside the bubble, you wouldn't notice, but around the perimeter of the torsion manifold, yeah, there would be stretched time. That's exactly right, and this has been well documented in Einstein's special relativity. You can do a web search or look it up in a book, but there's something called frame drag, and what frame drag is in any rotating body, and the Earth demonstrates this, and we measured it. In fact, our Air Force did this many years ago, and it's been well documented. If imagine now you have a bowl of pudding and you're stirring the bowl with a spoon, and you know where the spoon's spinning at a certain velocity, but then the pudding around it kind of, as the further away you go from the spoon, then it slows down a little bit. But the pudding around the edge of the spoon is being stretched around with it. So think of the time-space continuum being stretched around the edge. If you're at the equator of the planet, and you send a probe up a certain distance and then measure the difference in time on the surface versus out there in space, you wouldn't, in fact, see an elongation of time. It wouldn't be very much, but it's certainly measurable. And, in fact, there were experiments on Wright-Patterson, which have been well documented, where there was a spinning plasma body experiment, and they could, you know, they got a couple of nanoseconds, but it was a measurable distortion of time around the outer edge of these spinning plasma bodies. I mean, this is all, it's all part of standard physics, actually. But the concept is usually referred to as frame drag.
Okay, Ree is in Salt Lake City on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Charles Altman. Why am I saying that? Go ahead, Ree.
Whatever, Lossman, if you wish. I don't know.
Ree?
First of all, I want to say hi, Ian, and I really enjoy listening to you because I think you ask really thought-provoking questions.
And I agree with that.
Just wanted to let you know that. But my question or comment was first about the Hadron Collider. Sure. I mean, my thing is, I don't care what country it is, but for every action is a reaction. And so just like oil, you know, drilling for oil, this planet is alive. Thing for us to live on, and don't you think it's like if I poked holes in you, wouldn't it affect you after a while, kind of thing? So
I'm sorry, it's a little hard to hear.
Why? What was the point of doing that, and does it affect the control of the weather, or like the other gentleman said, the tides?
Right. If we were to look at
you're messing with the natural order of things, and just like man always does. Now everything is so convenient, nobody knows how to do anything.
Well, you know, and then thank you, Ree. I'll tell you what, there's a term for what you're talking about, Ree, and that's the implications wheel. That's what my friend Joel Barker refers to it. And we don't actually spend a lot of time figuring out all of the spokes of the implication wheel around the things that we do. So she's talking about the Hadron Collider.
Okay.
Is there really a greater good that's going to be achieved from this versus the potential loss of having this?
Okay, I couldn't quite hear. It was a little hard to hear, and I apologize. But
right.
I think if I understand what you're saying, then I certainly rest that. The potential goes in many directions, one of which would be if, for instance, it were shown that a proton-antiproton power source could be derived from this kind of a process, as one example. Just imagine now, I mean, right now, our entire planet, I mean, whether or not you want to buy into the carbon credits thing, that's a whole separate argument, but I absolutely would agree that our atmosphere, our water, and our land is being poisoned with chemicals. We're drowning in our own ocean of toxins from all the fossil fuels and all the other things that we do, our industrial processes. We have to do something different. We have to. We can't do this. And if China and India and all the rest of the world suddenly goes online, they go, you know, hog wild with putting about all their coal-burning plants and that many more cars in the road, et cetera, nobody's going to win. This is a downward spiral. So this is the time to be looking at other alternatives, no matter how exotic they might be. And if we can actually extract from this kind of experimentation another kind of power source that does not rely on any of these chemicals, but in fact has an entirely different way of extracting energy from a relatively, you know, harmless process, that in itself, I think, is a big enough reward to be worth the try.
Let's go to Ace in Kansas City for Charles Osmond, and then we'll switch over to open lines coming up at the top of the hour. Ace?
Charles, hello, and hello, Ian. I've talked to you before from the home of Gates Barbecue in Kansas.
Oh, yeah, we have, actually. I'm big on Gates.
Yes. I was born on Wright-Patterson and a kid at Edwards.
Okay.
A little person, a midget. I was the ace technician in the Silicon Valley from 1975 to 2001.
Okay.
In 83, I worked on some Star Wars stuff at E-Tech called physics.
Yeah, yeah.
We made a lot of acoustic wave theory chips that are nano-sized technology 20 years before it all happened. I also worked on some SDI stuff, magnetic lenses at E-Tech. Anyway, I kind of want to react to your comment about the Chinese. While I was at Loral, they walked out with pieces of satellite that they now have space program for. And while I was at Stanford, I worked on some TRW Block 14 satellites and such like that, space station. Worked on some Tesla-type magnetic bottle like you worked on at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And my question is I've been on disability for since 2003, but I'm having dreams of future technology again. I know how this stuff works. How do I get a job on gravity manipulation?
That's a great question. And, you know, let me just back away, and I want to answer your question, but also if I can just address the larger view. I am very, very concerned about our country and the number of people who don't have jobs. And I know that in your area, Ian, it's very bad. In fact, here in California, it's really bad.
Yeah, our I think it's probably 20, worse for you.
We're $20 billion in the hole. That's our state budget that they'll tell us about. I think it's actually much, much worse. And I, even though we have this temporary stimulus, I don't buy it for a nanosecond. I think we're going to have some pretty rough waters ahead. And if we can't get people back to work in whatever capacity, I mean, we're done. So we really have to focus on this. Now, in terms of how do you get a job in the gravity sort of business, as it were, that's a really eclectic, specialized field. My background's in material science, and so it's kind of a weird thing because the fact that I spent a lot of years looking at how to create nanocrystals and very unusual kinds of alloys and weird ceramics and everything, these materials were like the pathway to get at all these other different devices that are being developed. So that's one possible avenue. I don't have a direct answer, but I would probably start in the area of physics and or materials and try to find out which institution might be funding programs that would be looking for. I mean, I should probably ask you, it depends on your background. I mean, I don't know what kind of engineering
Let me jump in and say, if I heard Ace correctly, I heard him say he was on disability opposed to unemployment. Well, that may be different in that he may be qualified for funding for further education.
Yeah,
what education would somebody need in order to be qualified to be doing any of this gravity work in the future?
I would start with physics, of course, obviously, and I would probably start looking into superconductivity and some of the other materials properties that lend themselves to the powering of these systems. That's kind of where I see the main effort that I know of being spent.
I'm a firm believer in getting new degrees for new directions.
Absolutely.
Maybe that'll help. Jim is in Tulsa, Oklahoma on Coast to Coast for Charles Osmond. Jim?
Yeah, Charles and Ian, good program tonight. I'm really enjoying this.
Thank you.
Back in the early 70s, I was stationed in Florida down at Eglin Air Force Base.
Okay.
And I was at a remote site. I was working security police at the time. And out over the Gulf Coast area, this was on a Saturday evening about 5 o'clock during this time of year, the whole sky had just lit up with a bright blue and purple color.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminded me of the situation in the Norway area right now.
Right.
And I was wondering, back then, I realize the technology is a lot further advanced now than then, but what sort of technology do you think they were playing with back?
Well, interesting you should point that out, because I have a friend who I can't name, of course, but he's in the Navy, let's put it that way, and he tells me some of his comrades they were out at sea in a ship. And actually, I don't remember the exact year. It was somewhere in the mid-80s, but they saw this giant dome of light suddenly cover the sky. It was very interesting the way I described it. So as I was saying before, the stuff that I could have some possible comment about is that there's been a lot of efforts to disperse certain kinds of metals or other chemistries into the atmosphere and then light it up with either a charge or with a beam. And that's been, you know, that's been an ongoing project for a number of years. So whether you saw one of our experiments or one of their experiments, as it were, I'm going to guess it was probably something like that, where they used one of these well-known elements or combination elements to change the energy status of the atmosphere for some kind of experiment they were working at the time.
We have just time to probably get one more call in, maybe two. Let's go to Dennis on a wildcard line for Charles Ostman. We're talking about, of various subjects, all of which come back to the After Dark newsletter that's just out
but
now.
The ill-fated comment about Ian, which I apologize for profusely. I hope I can make amends for that.
That's fine. Go ahead, Dennis. You're talking with Charles Ostman. Go ahead.
Excellent show. I just wanted to throw in a vote of confidence for a lot of what Charles is saying, and I was surprised when he said he was into material sciences. I've done some work in the accelerator industry.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And I understand what he's talking about, and there's actually, it recently aired on one of the Science Channel's program, and it explained almost in layman's terms the idea of the gravity bubble and high-speed transport.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wanted to validate and say, especially what he said, if someone wants to get into that industry,
yeah,
is you really need some school to get in the door.
Yeah, true. But
material sciences is a great one because it applies all the disciplines to understand the property of the materials.
Correct.
In these fantastic energy envelopes. The key to doing any of this stuff that Mr. Osgood is talking about is to supply enough energy to be able to do it.
That's right.
That formula is correct. It's all possible. It's all explained by quantum mathematics.
Yeah, yeah.
And
going back to the earlier gentleman, because I think Ian's point was great, I'd be really looking forward to getting, you know, access to some kind of education that, and it may be because of the stimulus bill, I would be looking at government grants or anywhere where superconductivity is being studied. There's a lot of work in superconductive ceramics. That's a big field right now. There's something called superpolaron chemistry. That's a kind of a subset within that realm. Anything to do with putting a lot of energy into a very small amount of space or transmutation of elements. That's the other one. That's the big ticket right now.
I got 30 seconds left for you, Charles Ostman. Tell me what's the next I told you so that you think we ought to look for in the news that you might see in the near future coming up in 2010 that validates any of what we've talked about tonight?
Oh, you'll see more interesting things in the sky. And the other topic that we didn't talk about, but I would talk about sometime in the future, synthetic biology. The whole idea of being able to build, design our organisms on demand, that very much is what we're seeing right now.
We certainly need that. We need new technologies. We need new industries in order to create more jobs.
Absolutely.
And so it's more visionaries like yourself out there encouraging that kind of growth. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to chat with you. And I look forward to getting back in this conversation sometime in the new year. Keep an eye on the skies for us, Charles Ostman. We'll go open lines coming up for the rest of the show. Where will you take us next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett.